Welcome, dear heart. Blog Talk Radio. Welcome, dear heart, to the Intentional Family Hour. I'm your host and transformational coach, Adriana Smith. It's my joy to help survivors of toxic past relationships to learn how to thrive by creating family that is nurturing, rooted in love, healthy in its respect and its boundaries, and intentional in this world. Over the past 10 years, not only have I used the principles I'll be sharing on this show in my own life, but I've had the privilege of coaching clients worldwide to create meaningful family relationships of their own. So today, for many listeners who are not familiar with my story, I'd like to share with you a little bit about what that journey's been like and how it's led me to do this work. Okay. So these days, I'm really, truly grateful for so many things. I have a loving, supportive, a sensitive, and caring husband. I get to enjoy and create community wherever I go. I get to travel and help people in different parts of the world in the U.S. And I enjoy sharing the gifts that have been given to me in a conscious business. But it wasn't always this way. So I just wanted to share with you a little bit about what it was like coming from the other side of the world to where I am right now. I was born in Eastern Europe in a little tiny country of Romania at a time when things were in a lot of turmoil at that point. I am the oldest of four kids, and my dad was a minister, I guess you would call him a pastor, and my parents married very young. So, but as early as I can recall, there was, even though I had affection from my parents, it was a difficult family life. And one of the earliest memories I have is my dad saying, you know, that it's just too bad you weren't born a boy. So I don't know, you know, looking back, some of that might have been due to cultural pride. It might have been, you know, it was a very patriarchal environment. And, or it might have been church values that caused them to believe like that and to speak to his daughter this way. But for whatever reason, it is one of my earliest memories, and getting close to my dad was very difficult. I did have a bond with my mom, but again, she was very young when she had me. And, you know, as I was growing up, the more that the years went on, the more I learned that I became the parent to both of them in a lot of ways, but I felt that way with her as well. So unfortunately, looking back, those, especially those first few years, maybe age four, age five, were very violent, and they were violent in the home. And my dad was a violent person, and he was an alcoholic, and that compounded some of that problem of his aggression. And I don't really, you know, I didn't calculate at a young age where all of that had come from, but I remember hearing stories about alcoholism running in the family. And so, like many families that you might be familiar with, you know, the talk is around the idea that, you know, if it's happened in prior generations, that it must be just something that comes up from one generation to another, and there's not much that can be done, or there's just a tendency for that. And I think within our nuclear family, there was a certain amount of acceptance, looking back to that behavior. And wasn't until I was much older that I came to learn what the impact of heredity is on something like this, and our lifestyles, and of course the choices that we make moving forward. But I do remember listening to a lot of family fighting and difficulty and arguments in the home. And I do remember promising myself that whatever this was, because I didn't have a name for the kind of pain that I was in back then, and the fear that I lived with all the time. But I do remember vowing to myself that whatever this was, this had to end with me. And I didn't understand that that's not something that ends by flipping a switch, of course, because of my age. I didn't know how that was going to happen, but I knew I had a commitment to making a difference in the story of the family legacy. Okay, so the violence didn't just exist in the home for me. It was also, we had martial law at the time in the country, and there was a lot of political restriction. There was violence in the streets. I also remember we were, because of our involvement in the church, we were raided by the government at different times, by the local police. I remember midnight raids in our home, being woken up in the middle of the night, and to chaos and trying to figure out where to go, what to do next. And I remember being a part of peaceful prayer gatherings in the homes of other church members and being raided by the police. And the police were violent to the peaceful community that I was with. And I also have a memory of, you know, talking about people disappearing from the community, family members, and, you know, it was a constant threat of not knowing where our lives would lead us the following day or in the coming weeks or months or years of our lives, because there was so much unrest and so much control that the government exerted over us. So all that just to say, you know, my family did become eventually political and religious refugees, but it just seemed like everywhere I looked, there was legacy, for there was a tradition and an acceptance for violence and pain and fear, of course. And, you know, and of course the acceptance was there for the alcoholism and the constant fighting. And eventually my parents did manage to secure looking for us to leave the country. And we were stripped of our citizenship in order for us to be able to buy tickets to leave the country. And we sold everything that we had and left, not unlike what we see in Europe happening today. And so, yes, there is a very real part of me that understands what people go through nowadays when they leave their homeland from a lot of unrest and chaos. And but we did arrive in New York in the U.S., and we were blessed to receive sponsorship in the 80s, and I'm very grateful for that. You know, and looking back, even though I had to learn English on no notice, basically, I was happy to have a new start and to have new experiences and to try and make new friends. I did have difficulty in school. I never really did well in school, even way past the time that I learned English when I should have done better. But I think that it was very difficult to process that much change in a short span of time. So also I wound up getting skipped a grade, which made it very challenging. And I had difficulty making friends. So I was very, very shy. And, you know, looking back, I'm not convinced that that was just my nature to be shy, but I think living with the kind of family life that I had, it was at times, it made it, I don't know what the right word would be, but I just did a lot more observing of the world around me than I was comfortable engaging. So this played on my school life and my grades, of course. But I did have a positive experience in that once I learned enough English and I got to navigate the school community a little bit, I learned that there were social workers and guidance counselors and people there that wanted to help. And so I started to reach out and I started to ask for help. And this eventually led me to start reading self-help books at as early as 13. And I just had an insatiable desire to learn about the dysfunctions and to learn about the causes of certain kinds of behaviors, of unhappiness in families, of why people played certain roles, what motivated certain people to treat one another the way that they do. And it helped to relieve some of the pressure that I was experiencing at home. I think looking back, I played the role of parent to my siblings as well, but I remember my brother and sisters and even my mom saying, I always feel so much clearer after talking to you. And this has been, you know, for as far back as my teens that I could remember, that I just recall being a go-to person in the home. And not everyone in the family shared the same interest in, to the same extent that I had in the self-help material. But I was okay with that because we were able to, you know, sometimes talk more openly. It caused more of a dialogue. But by the time I had left for college, the family disintegrated. My father had left the family, and we had difficulty keeping together. And I knew one thing that was becoming very clear to me, that even though, whereas in the early childhood I had, we weren't really allowed to talk about a lot of the pain we were going through. Once my dad left and a lot of that threat was gone, we began to bond over our past pain. And I got very clear as I was heading into college and beyond that I didn't want to bond over that. And that's something that Al-Anon families and Al-Anon gatherings taught me, was that, you know, you want that closeness to be on constructive and healthy and wholesome experiences that you create going forward. And for me, I had difficulty with that. So it is interesting to me looking back because, you know, when you feel cornered, you make different choices than when you get to breathe freely and you can be at ease. And it's been an interesting journey for me, just witnessing how different members of the first tribe in my family chose different paths for themselves and dealt with the same experience of violence in the home and difficulties in our lives in different ways. Okay. I always wanted closeness, but I just found I couldn't get support. So the support that I was able to get for myself was in outside sources. And I really pushed myself hard to try and learn as much as I could. Eventually, I did marry an American man and raised the most amazing little girls in a New York suburb. But I managed to attract a partner much like my dad, unfortunately, and another wounded man who was very unhappy. And I experienced aggression, excessive control, abuse all over again. That lasted about, I'm not quite sure, it was between 15 and 18 years, that relationship altogether. And eventually, I got up the strength to walk away, which is something I hope that my girls will get to fully grasp at some point in their lives, because it is one of the most difficult choices a woman has to make. And I do hope that they too will come to understand that bullying of any sort is not okay. You know, we talk about bullying and we have all these wonderful campaigns for bullying that takes place in our outside communities like the schools, but we don't go far enough, as far as I'm concerned, because not only did I experience a lot of this on the home front, but I also had lots of opportunities to witness this happening in bedroom communities and communities where it shouldn't have been the case, where people weren't necessarily suffering due to economics and you know, impoverishment, where we could pin it up to that and say, well, folks don't know any better. Bullying and anti-bullying is a topic that comes in and out of conversation nowadays just by virtue of living in today's world. Unfortunately, you know, we stop talking about these things once the front door closes. And that was a lot of my experience. You know, socializing was a challenge for me because, you know, the front put forward outside the front door was very different than what happened in the home. Okay, so for me, the scapegoating, family drama, and the trauma of having everything and every level of support methodically removed or tampered with is something I hope you will never have to experience. For me, it's been years of healing and inner work to be able to stand on my feet once more. I remember at one point as I was leaving and I was speaking with a woman who ran a shelter in the area, and she said to me, I asked her, how long do most women who she's worked with, how long do they take to recover from a battered situation and from a domestic violence experience? And she says to me, 5 years. And my head was just boggled to think, you know, 5 years seemed like an eternity to me. And yet, sure enough, you know, even knowing everything that I knew, even equipped with all of the information I had studied, it takes far more to acquire the skills to stand on your own two feet after an experience like that. And in my case, I wound up having to start from scratch in terms of creating family as well from scratch. So that's very difficult to be in a situation like that, because I lost my entire support system once I decided to step away from what seemed to be a white picket fence life. So, and the irony of it was that, I don't know if any of you have also experienced something like this, or if you've had the experience of coming out of a narcissist relationship or a toxic relationship, or if you've experienced domestic violence and finally had a chance to step outside. I thrived as soon as I was out, despite everything I had been threatened to. You know, I constantly heard, you know, you're never going to be able to stand alone. And I heard this not just from my ex-husband, but I heard it from family. I heard it from everyone that I turned to. You won't manage on your own. You'll be on the street. You know, not only did I thrive, but I had community respect almost immediately. And I was getting that from worldwide folks that I connected with, clients, you know, people that I did business with, and I was able to cultivate community, no less. I had a chance to experience success because I could function better, and I had a chance to experience loyal friendships. And so why do these things happen? You know, when I look back, I wish there was an easy answer. And I wish that I could talk to my younger self and offer her the guidance. But truth be told, you know, I don't have any regrets about those experiences, because in my heart of hearts, I held to the idea that I had, even as a young child, that I wanted somehow to make a difference. And I'm still on this journey. I'm still learning quite a lot. But, you know, the skills learned along the way, I mean, there is no price for that. I mean, there's just no price tag for that. There is nothing, there's no force on this earth as unstoppable as a woman who rises out of a difficult situation like that. You know, and my commitment and my vow to myself to change the story is something that I continue to be passionate about, and has eventually led me to this body of work. Okay. But today I just want to ask you if this is something that, you know, you've seen, or you know someone who's going through it, or you have this in your past. Who are we if we're not the parents to our kids, if we're not the kids to our parents, if we're not spouses to the ones that we've married and the ones we become partners with? Okay. Who are we at the end of the day? Because this is something I really had to sit with and ask myself, and I sit with my clients and ask, you know, do you remember who you were before all of this? In order to backtrack and rediscover your sense of worth, it's an important question to ask yourself. You were someone of worth. You were someone of value before you could perform a role in the family, before you were assigned a role in your family, in your first tribe. You had intrinsic value I hope you take the time to think about that and to just let it sink in. You have intrinsic value just by virtue of existing and breathing in the place where you are. You don't have to produce something. You don't have to play a role. And in fact, until you connect to that place of worth that you arrived in this world with, you will find it difficult to show up in your relationships the way you need to. You will find it difficult to bond and connect to people in the way that you want to. You will find communication difficult. You will find it difficult to negotiate for what you need and what you want from folks. You know, another critical question we need to ask ourselves is, you know, that mirroring that our first tribe provides that helps us gauge who it is we are and gives us our sense of identity. Do you ever wonder, what if it's faulty? Which is the case in every dysfunctional home. You know, what if the mirrors are more like those funny mirrors at the circus? And what you get reflected back is not so much an accurate, clear picture of who you are in this world, but rather something distorted based on ideas of the past that are dysfunctional, that are unhealthy. Do you ever think about that? And then I would have you ask yourself, who are you if your first tribe's mirroring is missing? Because that is who we are in relationship to ourselves. There are, you know, the world we live in now, we live with so much adversity happening all around us. And, you know, there's so much injustice if you look around, and there's so many extreme situations and outcomes that happen in different parts of the world. And if we don't have a tribe around us or a circle around us that supports us and mirrors back who it is we truly are, where does our strength come from? You know, where does our sense of identity come from? And I think it's so much more important these days to be able to sit with ourselves and to provide our own inner mirroring. And we do that. This is one of the key aspects of the coaching that I do with clients, is a process by which we get to sit and be alone and base that mirroring on our innate self-worth and reconnect with that. Because the interesting thing that happens is, once you can provide that mirroring to yourself, no one can ever take that away. There is no relationship that can replace that. You can be in the most wonderful partnership and you can be with your soulmate. But if you get to do that for yourself, imagine how powerful and what courage you can step forward with in the world around you, because no longer are you depending on outside relationships outside yourself, and the relationships with your tribe to be the key providers of your sense of worth. Okay, so, you know, I want to remind you today that no matter how dysfunctional, how toxic, and how painful past relationships might have been in the family for you, don't call it family if it doesn't behave like family. Okay? I know this is a concept that's hard to accept, because from primitive times we've been told that we cannot function on our own. It's a primal thing, you know. And yet, even as recently as this week, I came across an example, I believe it was in Ghana, where there's still traditions and practices in the world that scapegoat. They literally single someone out. It's usually a child, a female child. And it's still done to this day. And the victim doesn't know why they're being outcast. And so it's in our biology by now, it's in our cells by now to be afraid of being scapegoated, to be afraid of being banished, to be afraid of standing alone in the world. But I'm here to share with you that you can begin again, just as I have. Okay, and if I could do it, and I was always, the interesting thing about a lot of this is that the scapegoating, it usually happens to the family member that is more sensitive, as a lot of you will confirm from your own experiences. They will often be the empaths and the truth tellers. Okay. But that doesn't mean that you cannot begin again. And that, you know, there's a misconception there in this world that we live in, that that which is vulnerable is weak. And the one who is quiet is weak and unaware and naive in the world. But often what I have found in my work with clients is that they turned out to be the strongest among those families. And another interesting observation for me has been that, you know, these kinds of occurrences, you know, let's just take the example of a toxic family. You know, these behaviors are passed down generation after generation. And I can share with you story after story after story of clients who have come up through many of these generations, and the family, the dysfunction causes families to implode. I mean, it progresses, it's chronic, it's something that shifts over time. It doesn't just occur sporadically. There is a momentum to it. And over time, if it's not addressed, a family, an entire family, will cave in on itself. And what winds up happening is that that's where the relationships disintegrate and communication breaks down. And I'm seeing a lot of that with the folks that I work with. I wonder if you have not been affected by this in one way or another. Seems so many people that I speak with have at least one relationship like that in their family nowadays. And my observation has been that technology now allows us easily to disengage from people and to disconnect. And we've already isolated ourselves very much from the connection to our tribes and to our communities. Take a look at our suburban lifestyle. I mean, you can go from car to house and from house to car to work and to all the places you're committed to going and never know your neighbor, never know your who lives up the block and what their story is. And that's just, you know, I want to say that this is an American epidemic, except that I've lived in other parts of the world and I have found the same to be carried on in other places. And so, you know, maybe it has more to do with reaching a certain level of economic comfort or stability. I don't know. I can't quite explain why those socioeconomics work that way, but it seems that people cloister themselves, and it's just the common lifestyle for a lot of folks. And actually, I've lived in affluent communities, and it's even more exaggerated, the level of isolation. And what the result of that is, not just that, you know, we don't know one another, but that what goes on behind closed doors becomes a matter of shame. And people go to great lengths to cover up when there's a dysfunction or when something doesn't work right. And also what I've observed is that folks have a greater difficulty handling rejection out in the greater world. And they have a greater difficulty handling adversity or difficult experiences like loss when, you know, that's just part of life's cycles. Everything can't constantly continue and perpetuate. Every opportunity doesn't last forever. Every connection doesn't last forever. Our health doesn't last forever at the same level that we had it when we were young. Relationships change, people change. The folks we grew up with are no longer part of our circles. And, you know, change is much more difficult to handle when we live in isolation to one another. I'd love to be able to open a social dialogue on this. I'd love to be able to broaden this conversation. And I'd love to be able to get rid of some of these taboos that we've created. Because the truth of it is that life is short. And the truth of it is that we all go through times of change and we all experience chaos at times. That's just part of nature. We would be the exception to nature if those things didn't occur. But our kids and their kids often paired. They're often caught off guard because of the isolation that we participate in. And there's no shame in not having it all together. There's different seasons of life, and sometimes we're highly productive, and sometimes we need to learn new things, and that's okay. Our kids need to hear these kinds of things from us in today's society. And our kids also need to hear from us that it's okay to rebuild that inner circle. I've been able to do that, and, you know, some of that happened because I was at peace about people making different choices and choosing different loyalties. I made peace with that. And I released them in love because sometimes we love folks from afar. And it's okay to do that. That's not something I was taught. Because I came up through the legacy and the tradition of you can't function alone. But I came to find that it's not the case. I came to find that it's okay to reinvent yourself. It's okay to rebuild your life from scratch if you need to. In fact, it's good to do that. It's a good habit to be in. It's a good practice and a good lifestyle to, instead of keeping folks beholden to you, to give them that freedom, to enjoy them while you have them, to appreciate your encounter, however long that lasts. It may last weeks, it may last months, it may last years. And I hope it does for you in many of your relationships. But practicing conscious relationships means we never want to control people. Even when they make a commitment, even when they make a vow, we never want to control them. You know, at the most I've ever been able to do is to hold a person accountable to their own word. And even then, an individual, a sentient being, has the right, if they choose, and if they're able to choose, to change their mind. No one owes us a connection. And that's a very difficult concept today to accept. I think that maybe we're at a juncture where we need to evolve in our understanding of relationships. Because in the past, we've exerted control over others. We've held commitments and vows over the heads of everyone else. But truth be told, even my own kids get to exercise free will to participate in a connection with me or not. Just the same as all our kids do. They are their own individuals and they get to choose. And you know, it's when we start to understand that the worth that we have to offer, that we begin to see a conscious relationship is a privilege. And let's flip that around. If I can get you to embrace your worth, I want to invite you to understand that everyone who knows you is privileged to know you, because there will never be another you. What you have to bring to this world is unique. The trick with this is not to hold it over other people's heads. Not to say, you know, you owe me because I'm more special than you are. We're all equally special, and we're all unique to one another. In intentional family, what occurs is every member celebrates one another. Each member uplifts one another, and each member benefits as a result equally. There isn't this hierarchy where, you know, the parents need to net more, or mom needs to get more, or dad needs to get more, or the kids get everything. That is the old paradigm. That is the old legacy that's created skewed relationships. You know, we do live in so many extremes now. And when we look at the global violence and the injustice that takes place, the answer to all of these extremes that I see is learning to fully be present to ourselves and to one another. Because what successes we're able to achieve in the nuclear family, we can experience in the world. But if we don't tend to our own nest and we don't tend to our own souls and our relationship to ourselves, and we don't treat one another with the dignity and the love and respect that is unconditional, then we can't expect to find it out in the world when we look around. So, you know, what I'm reaching for is to create a precedent where, as we said, every member celebrates and supports, but also allows. So the folks that I work with usually arrive exhausted and drained. They're good people, and they have extremely high value, and often they're healers, they're teachers in their own right. They are uplifters of other folks around them. But it's been a real lesson for me to learn that most scapegoats and most ostracized folks that I've worked with are the empaths. In the segment of the population that I work with that are targeted parents, for example, who experience being alienated in their own families from their own kids, this is especially powerful because these folks, you know, they're not randomly selected. It's very clear that a pattern is emerging where they each had some very sensitive attributes to bring to their former families. And, you know, bullying, mobbing behavior in families, this sort of stuff thrives from the pacts of silence of dysfunctional family. Let me say that again. Bullying and mobbing behavior in families thrives from the pacts of silence
of dysfunctional family. All it takes for these kinds of things to occur is the agreement, a mutual agreement among dysfunctional family to allow it. Because there will be some tendency towards this. And if left unaddressed, this is the kind of thing that occurs. And this is how I wind up working with parents who are alienated from their own kids. It occurs because family members allow it and they don't speak up. So this is one of the reasons I'm so passionate about calling good people forward to stand up for good values and to stand up for the things that they believe in and the ideals that cause a family to thrive. Okay, but most people I meet out in the world take the approach of, I have to put up with it. And they resign. They resign that this is just the way of things. This is just the way of family. What am I going to do? They shrug their shoulders, throw their hands up. I have to just put up with it. No, you don't. You can invite family members, even dysfunctional family members, into a new vision. Yet, if they choose not to participate, you get to close the door. The key here is the first portion. There's an invitation process. You know, even in my situation, I've done this process. I've done the invitations. I have created precedents for mutual dignity and respect and for unconditional love and created an invitation to the table. If you know that you've offered this, even in a dysfunctional family, you have peace of mind that once you move on, you've done everything you could. It is the family that's unwilling to come to the table and to discuss differences and to discuss differing values. It is the families that are unwilling to look at treatments and behaviors that don't work. That unwillingness to face those past legacies that don't work. It's that unwillingness that breaks families apart. That is what makes the difference between an intentional family and a family that remains in the past. And unfortunately, more and more people are losing family members and they're losing the cohesion of that first tribe to these kinds of choices. Sometimes, oftentimes, too often, I should say. Traditional families are more committed to the past. They're more committed to keeping things status quo. They're more committed to silence. They're more committed to overlooking the things that hurt them and one another. They're more committed to stories of judgment towards one another. They're more committed to old ideas of one another, outdated reputations, past mistakes, which is something I see very often when Paul and I work with families in recovery. That is the breaking point. That is the point that makes the difference to whether a family moves on through the changes needed for the future or remains behind and disintegrates. Because the truth is, just like with all things in life, and Paul and I talk about this all the time, there is no such thing as stuck in place. There is no such thing. It may seem that way, that relationships stagnate, but the truth is they don't stagnate because one or both members eventually lose trust or they lose connection. And so nothing truly stagnates, but rather disintegrates. So this is an ongoing conversation we're having, and it's a very important conversation. We'll be chatting a lot more about this on future shows. If you don't evolve, you're going to de-evolve. You're going to disintegrate and grow backwards. And it's so important that we make these choices. And it takes a lot of courage to drop the past. It takes a lot of courage to change with tradition. It takes a lot of courage to let go of what didn't work. It takes a lot of courage to let go of, let's say there was a track record of behavior that was dysfunctional. Takes a lot of courage to shed the past and to reach for something entirely new. So when I invite you into creating a new vision, this is a process that requires you to burn the bridge, so to speak. It requires you to take only what you need for the next phase of your journey, because the past is too heavy and folks don't know how not to judge. So if you carry the stories of the past, you can't build a new future because of the weight of judgments of the past. Okay. So what kinds of coaching do I do? Just briefly to share with you, you're welcome to reach out at any point, but the best way that I work with folks is to offer them a set of intensives, okay, rather than the weekly back and forth. I just find that it's best to laser in on the problem areas and give them the kind of dedicated focus that these kinds of wounds from First Tribe require. Okay, so we get to dive deep and heal old dysfunctional legacy wounds in those intensives. We get to be okay and be supported in the process of letting go. This is extremely difficult for folks to do. So, we also get to discover what it is you stand for and align to it. And when we do the core values inventory, and of course, last but not least, is design intentional relationships based on those things. The truth is that we need community and family around us. We do need to have this. We don't just drop off a cliff. I'm not encouraging Lone Ranger kind of a future. But who told you that you have to settle? You know, life is short. The cost of inaction, I think, is too great. I want to invite you today to begin a new legacy of healthy, wholesome relationships. I want to invite you not to give in and to base a sense of togetherness by biology, but to be bonded by love and support in freedom and in celebration of one another. And to create a space where every member thrives, not just some. And if this is something you want to bring into your life, it's my privilege to support your healing on this journey. You deserve unconditional love. Till next time, this is Adriana Smith.